It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Welcome to our new program on WPR. A fresh new WPR is here. We've reorganized our statewide networks into news and music. You're with us here on WPR News.
We hope you enjoy the show for the next hour. If you are looking for music right now, don't worry. You can still find the music you love. Go to WPR.org/new for full schedules and signals and to listen online. Thanks for being with us today.
Now, crews are getting to work on a controversial portion of the Cardinal Hickory Creek transmission line in Grant County. They're stringing the final mile between Dubuque County, Iowa, and Dane County, but conservation groups continue to fight its construction in court.
The Wisconsin Wildlife Federation and Driftless Area Land Conservancy are among the groups that sued to block a land exchange that allows for construction through a national wildlife refuge.
We check in on the latest legal standings of this 102-mile high-voltage line. Danielle Kading is a reporter covering the environment, energy, and northern Wisconsin at the Superior Bureau of Wisconsin Public Radio. Danny, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me on your first show, guys.
Well, the Cardinal Hickory Creek transmission line is nearly finished. What is this legal conflict at this juncture of the project?
Well, back in March, conservation groups, including the Driftless Area Land Conservancy and Wisconsin Wildlife Federation, sued several federal agencies to halt construction of the transmission line through the Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife Refuge. And they're basically challenging a proposed land swap between utilities and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And basically, the federal agency is exchanging a part of the refuge near Cassville, where the line is slated to cross, for another piece of property in Grant County that was offered by utilities. And so that's set off a series of legal actions. But ultimately, utilities were able to close on that land swap, and now they've begun work to build at that crossing near Cassville, even though legal battles are still ongoing.
Can you talk more about this exchange of land? Why don't some conservation groups see it as an equal exchange? And also talk about the acreage here.
Sure. So basically with the land swap, conservation groups took issue with the short window for public comment. I think it was only about 2 weeks that they were given to review the latest environmental analysis and a benefits analysis of that exchange by federal agencies. And then also, they don't think the property that's been offered by utilities is as valuable as the existing refuge parcel. An attorney for the conservation groups has said that appraisals for the land show it's worth less per acre than the refuge land. And plus, they say the Grant County property, or what's being called the Wagner parcel, is surrounded by a rail line, an RV trailer park, an airport, and gravel pits. But utilities say they're providing more land in exchange for that refuge parcel, which is about 35 acres compared to the roughly 20 acres at the refuge crossing. And they contend that the land appraisals only take into account the commercial value of that property rather than the conservation value of the land that's being offered. And they are saying that the property in Grant County has been identified as unique habitat for mussels.
Okay, so different versions of how you look at these two properties. Danny, can you step back for a moment and explain the broader energy infrastructure and how this line will fit into that in the Midwest?
Sure. So this transmission line runs, like you were saying, 102 miles from Dane County to Dubuque County in Iowa, and the Midwest Regional Grid Operator and utilities have said this is an important project for tying renewable energy into the grid, as we're seeing utilities in the region retire coal plants and shift to other sources like wind and solar. And this project is expected to connect around 160 projects to the grid as part of that ongoing shift away from coal.
And are we talking really about the last mile of line stringing for this transmission project?
Yes, we are.
Wow. So, you know, what is the schedule for construction to proceed? Because it sounds like the judge wants to review some new aspects of the case, but construction has picked up again.
That's right. So for the schedule, it's not entirely clear because of that ongoing litigation. I can say that in March, utilities had expected to complete this last leg of the project by June. Obviously, that's not going to happen. But if it's allowed to move forward, it appears that utilities think they can get it wrapped up pretty quickly. But they haven't provided any updated timeline as those legal battles continue.
We're talking about the construction of the controversial Cardinal Hickory Creek Transmission Line project with WPR reporter Danielle Kading. Danny, you talked with attorney Howard Lerner, who represents the plaintiffs in this case. And Lerner is arguing that construction should not move forward until the legal case is resolved.
The transmission companies, in the meantime, are trying to rush and build before there can be meaningful judicial review. And it's time that the transmission companies hit the pause button and stop creating more damage where it need not occur.
Stop creating more damage. What kind of environmental damage does Lerner argue could occur in this wildlife refuge?
Well, right now, the utilities are prepping that site and they're doing surveying work and matting. But by the end of the month, they plan to start installing foundations for the towers that would be built at that crossing. And as that work continues, there will be clearing of roughly 36 trees. And I think conservation groups would say that, you know, once this work starts, you can't undo what's been done.
U.S. District Judge William Conley has not yet given a final ruling on this case. What are some possible outcomes that could be in play?
Well, the judge could seek to halt construction temporarily. And that's something that he did before when conservation groups first sued back in March. But after utilities appealed his ruling, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals has basically said that construction can move forward because Judge Conley didn't find groups would be likely to be successful in showing that that land exchange they're contesting is legal.
And you also reported that Judge Conley is holding off on this ruling as he examines new facts in the case. Do we know what those facts are?
Yeah, you know, some of the things that they're contesting, like one of the new findings that they've come across is that stuff that I mentioned before, where they're saying that there is an RV park, an airport, and gravel pits, and other items around there. And again, that these land appraisals show that the Wagner parcel, that Grant County property, is worth less per acre than the refuge land. So those are some of the new findings that they brought up in a hearing last week before Judge Conley. And basically the judge said that he wasn't going to rule right away. He wanted a chance to review some of the new findings that are being submitted before the court. And he would take that into account, as well as the Seventh Circuit's ruling that, you know, basically he hadn't shown that the groups would be successful on the merits of the case. So he's kind of trying to tread a fine line here, whether or not he has the ability to halt construction of the project at this point.
I also noticed on the side of the utility companies, there are some environmental and clean energy groups that are not opposed to this ruling, this final mile. Is that right?
Yeah, I think there are definitely some clean energy advocates out there that see the benefit of having this transmission line put into service, right? I mean, if there are 160 projects, and that was as of last fall, that were waiting to be tied into the grid, and that this transmission line would facilitate that, then that's a big deal for the region. And, you know, the Midwest Regional Grid Operator has identified this transmission line, this project, as one of the most important for facilitating that transition. And it's like one of the last of a tranche of projects that were put underway in the Midwest. So this is kind of like the final steps of this. And, you know, the Public Service Commission in Wisconsin first approved this project back in 2019. So we're coming up on 5 years now where we've been fighting over the future of this transmission line. And basically Judge Conley said, you know, at some point here, there's going to have to be a connection somewhere, whether it's across the river or going around the refuge. You know, this line is going to have to connect somewhere. And so is it going to cause the most damage at this refuge crossing, or is it going to cause the most damage somewhere else? I think there's lots of things that are being taken into account here as this is still proceeding through the federal court.
Danny, is there a backlog of clean energy projects, wind and solar, that is not being able to get to the energy grid that this transmission line could help alleviate?
Well, like I said, as of last fall, there are those 160 projects that were set to be tied into the grid via this transmission line. At least that's what utilities are saying. And so that's wind and solar projects that are set to be connected to the grid. But, you know, conservation groups have also argued along the way that, you know, it's not as much clean energy or renewable energy as utilities are making it out to be. They say that also there would be some fossil fuel projects like natural gas that would be facilitated through this transmission line project. And so I think there's just a disagreement over how we are conducting this clean energy transmission. These conservation groups have in the past argued that, you know, this is not the only way we can do this. We could maybe explore battery storage or local distributed energy use to provide the power that's needed to facilitate this transmission. And some of the arguments against that are that the technology is still developing. And, you know, we've just now been seeing some of those pilot projects come online where things are working with battery storage, but there's a lot yet to be figured out.
And very quickly here, what are the next steps that you're watching for?
Well, the litigation is ongoing. I think the next big decision would be whether the judge grants or denies conservation groups' latest request to halt construction. And as far as I can see, there's been no decision on that yet.
Danny, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kate.
Danielle Kading is a reporter covering the environment, energy, and northern Wisconsin at the Superior Bureau of Wisconsin Public Radio.
She was with us to share her latest reporting on the controversial Cardinal Hickory Creek transmission line construction and lawsuit in southwestern Wisconsin. Read more of her reporting on the case at WPR.org. Coming up, communities around Wisconsin have been experimenting with electric scooter apps and sharing programs with a wide variety of results. Find out why you'll see more of those scooters in one place and a lot fewer in another as we check in with Cities Big and Small. That's up next on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's been 5 years since Wisconsin passed a law regulating the use of electric scooters, opening the door for companies like Bird, Lime, Veo, and Spin to operate dockless scooter programs in cities across the state.
That followed a boom in the industry where companies raced to be the first to the market and hit the streets everywhere from Beloit to Green Bay.
Some Wisconsin cities saw success with electric scooters, providing a more convenient alternative to driving or walking. But others ran into trouble with misbehaving riders and scooters discarded around town.
We're checking in on how these electric scooter programs have gone in cities around the state and what lessons local leaders have learned along the way. Let's start in Wisconsin's largest metropolitan area, where the city of Milwaukee recently moved to make its pilot scooter program permanent. Zach Roeder is a senior transportation planner for the city of Milwaukee, where he oversees the city's dockless scooter program. Zach, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Take us back to 2019. Now, these electric scooter programs were kind of sweeping across the country, one city after another, it seemed like. Here they came. Companies are coming to Milwaukee. What was the city's approach to this kind of new concept in transportation?
The city understood that scooters were something that could add a lot of options for people to get around the city, making things better for people, you know, to move around. But we also understood that there were challenges with scooters and wanted to do things in a careful way. So the city developed a pilot program in 2019 to kind of have an initial test to kind of learn how scooters can work in Milwaukee and how we can make things work well. And we continued those. We kind of did multiple pilot studies then, also following up in 2021 after the pandemic, the peak of the pandemic, and then in 2022 to 2023.
And one key distinction that people may not think of is the docked scooter, meaning there's a place where the scooters go when you're done with them, to dockless. And that dockless was the big new innovation. Talk about how that works and how it went through those pilot programs.
Yeah, so dockless scooters have an advantage in that you can take them anywhere you want to go and leave them wherever you end up. So a lot of docked systems, like in Milwaukee, we have Bubbler Bikes, which is a docked bike share system. You can only go really within the limits of where those stations are. A dockless scooter program is great because it gives people the option all over the city to kind of go exactly where they want to go.
Now, what do we know about in these pilot programs? Now it's going full tilt, as I understand it. What do we know about how popular they are, how much users are embracing these dockless scooters in the city?
Yeah, we have seen really good ridership in Milwaukee. Some of the companies we work with actually have found that our scooters, you know, the scooters in Milwaukee have more trips per day per scooter than most cities across the country. So people in Milwaukee have really embraced them and found them as a way that's really convenient to get around, in our downtown. And in the east side is our densest parts of the city, and it's very popular there. But even spread throughout the city, we've seen really good ridership all over the place.
As a transportation planner, how do you see these fitting into the network? I've seen some people make the case that these solve the last mile problem. Okay, your bus gets you almost where you want to go or whatever. Are people using them for that last mile? Are they replacing trips in a car or a bus? Do we know how this is all fitting in together?
We see scooters as a really important part of the transportation system. Like you said, making that last mile connection to transit, connecting people to the MCTS bus routes in Milwaukee and to the destinations they want to get to that those routes may not serve. We also see them kind of tying in with all of the other mobility options, giving people choices. And that's something that ties in with other goals in the city, around reducing reckless driving, reducing vehicle miles traveled or reducing driving in general to create a more sustainable city and a city with more safe options for people to get around. They're safer for the community. So it kind of replaces some of those vehicles trips when people realize, oh, I can have a more fun and more enjoyable way to get around that maybe is better for the environment. It's maybe less expensive than taking their vehicle, trying to find parking and things like that. So people are, we are seeing people, embrace this and using it in a wide variety of different ways. And we really see it as an important part of our transportation system moving forward. This combined with our Bubbler bike share, it's really giving people new options on how they can move around the city and experience Milwaukee.
Now, I know in some cities where scooter programs started off whole hog, they went right in. One of the biggest complaints, and you touched on this earlier, was, hey, people are dropping their scooters in the place I like to park, or they're dropping them on the sidewalk. How do you try to regulate that if people in the city see scooters where they ought not to be? Is there a complaint mechanism?
We encourage people in Milwaukee, if they see scooters parked, in a way that's blocking people from moving around or kind of disorderly, you can always report it to our city through 286-CITY, our kind of direct phone number, or through the MKE mobile app. But we also see that scooters, in Milwaukee, we've seen it kind of improving compliance with parking. We've seen things getting better as people get more familiar with this. We've also, in our last pilot program from 2022 to 2023, we started adding what are called scooter corrals. So you might see them on the street in the parking lane, usually towards the end of a block where cars aren't allowed to park legally already when it's a certain distance to an intersection. But we kind of have these paint and post on street, marked for scooter parking zones where people, as they're riding, these are really easy for people to see. People feel comfortable parking their scooters there, and it really has helped improve the compliance of having the scooters not blocking things, having them in a more organized way, and give people a good, comfortable place to park their scooters.
Talking to Zach Roeder, senior transportation planner for the city of Milwaukee, about the city's dockless electric scooter programs. Zach, I assume the scooter companies themselves are going to make some money out of this. Does the city get a taste? Does this affect the city's bottom line?
Yeah, so this is another benefit of the program is that it does generate revenue for the city. So the scooter companies, you know, they're able to, you know, make money off of the program, but the city also gets a component of that that helps us to fund the administration of the program and build out some of this infrastructure. And it also kind of goes into our broader transportation fund to help the city continue to help make our streets safer and better for people walking, biking, taking transit, and yeah, making a overall a safer city for everyone.
And finally, Zach, we've seen some of these scooter companies rise and fall over the last few years. Do you feel like you've got a good long-term commitment from the people providing this service in Milwaukee?
And one thing with our program is we've also, because we have multiple operators, you know, if a company, you know, we understand, you know, this is, you know, these kind of micro mobility companies have had issues in the past, certain ones with having a kind of sustainable business model. You know, we definitely want to support the companies that, you know, we're working with, and, you know, and all of the scooter companies. We think that, you know, things have kind of become more stable over time with these companies. But we also, you know, have our system set up in a way that if one operator were to go away, we would still have another operator out there able to provide this valuable service for people in our community. And we can kind of go back to other companies and you know, get another operator as needed. But we feel good about the future of this of this space of scooter companies, and we think that you know, our city is kind of, you know, a lot of these companies are actually kind of, you know, recommending this kind of setup where you have these two companies to give them kind of a little bit more ability to make money to sustain themselves versus the three company model. So this is a you know, we see this as a good way for our city to kind of help these companies, but then have these companies also help us by being a stable, kind of committed long-term partner for our city and for our community.
Zach, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Zach Roeder is a senior transportation planner for the city of Milwaukee. He was with us to share how Milwaukee's dockless electric scooter program has done over its first few years.
While Milwaukee is making its program permanent, elsewhere in the state, the city of Appleton is trying to figure out its next steps.
The electric scooter company Bird was actually founded by an Appleton native, Travis VanderZanden, in 2017. The city implemented the scooters back in 2021.
Bud VanderZanden left the company last year, and Bird filed for bankruptcy this past December. That led Appleton to question whether or not the city should continue its scooter program.
Appleton Director of Public Works Danielle Block told the city's Municipal Services Committee that the city was hesitant to renew the partnership with Bird, given some of the problems it's had.
One was the restructuring from bankruptcy. Two was the payments still due. Those have been paid. And the last was just concerns on the operation of the birds, safety, and then the parking issues. And until we had a solution on that, that was staff's feedback after talking with Bird that we recommended we wouldn't move forward with an agreement until we had a solution in place.
Bird sent its principal government partnerships manager, Adam Davis, to meet with city leaders to address their concerns.
He said Bird is ready to bring in more advanced technology that will require users in Appleton to park their scooters in designated areas to prevent them from being left around town.
Picture a physical dock, but cut that out, and it's a virtual dock, but it controls them the same within centimeters that they have to be in the specific locations. In cities like Reno and others, it's yielded great success in this, and it has the least amount of restriction.
Bird says it's staying committed to Appleton, but the micromobility company hasn't taken the same approach in some smaller Wisconsin cities.
In 2022, a contractor working for Bird ended its electric scooter program in the city of Beloit, citing issues with the company.
And earlier this year, Bird announced that it was pulling out of Janesville after 2 years of operating in that city.
Nick Faust is the assistant to the city manager for the city of Janesville. He's here to help explain what happened with the scooter program in his community. Nick, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, as I understand it, Nick, earlier this year, the electric scooter company Bird said, hey, we are leaving the Janesville market. What kind of communication did the city get from them during that process?
Yeah, so, you know, the city had from the outside understood that Bird, the micromobility firm that had been operating in Janesville, was doing a bit of restructuring due to their own financial concern. And unfortunately, what we learned from them was, as a part of that, our market was not to be included in the 2024 season.
Did they seem to leave the door open? Hey, maybe someday we'll come back to Janesville, or is it pretty much a done deal for now?
If for now, it would be a done deal, but they did give some leeway that maybe should their conditions change, I think they might look to get back to the mid-markets like Janesville.
What did it look like in Janesville? Were people using these scooters? How was the program working before Bird left after that restructuring?
Yeah, so Bird had operated successfully from our perspective in Janesville for two seasons. Their last MOU or Memorandum of Understanding with the city deployed 250 scooters in our community. Believe it or not, we had just over 10,000 trips taken right here in little old Janesville on those scooters for just under 18,000 miles traveled. And I like those stats because I think they're quite impressive when you think about the size and the makeup of our community and our transportation network as it exists. So I think it shows that micro-mobility certainly had its own niche here in Janesville.
I talked to Zach about those from Milwaukee about those stray scooter problems out there. Is this something that you heard complaints about in Janesville, or did they did people play pretty well with those?
Yeah, so by and large, people certainly played pretty well with each other when it came to the dockless scooters in the right of way. That's not to say that there weren't concerns or complaints. Janesville was incredibly important by Bird's own metrics. Our local fleet manager was in the top 3% in the nation when it came to resetting those improperly parked scooters that may have been in the right of way. So I think as the program progressed, we saw rider behavior not only improve, but we saw an incredibly responsive fleet, local operator, I should say, mm-hmm. that took care of those things.
Did you have a sense of what people were doing with them? Recreational rides, part of their commute, weekend outings. What were people doing with these scooters?
Yeah, so the vast majority of trips, 81% actually for the 23 season, took place in our downtown, which certainly implies perhaps more of a leisure-based reason for why folks were riding the birds. But we also did see some select cases where, for example, in the summer month, we had one individual take 81 commutes to and fro from work. And so that was sort of an interesting piece because by and large, they were mostly sort of entertainment-based. But it was cool to kind of start to see those commutes or last mile trips start to crop up.
We're talking about dockless electric scooter programs in Wisconsin. Nick Faust is with us from Janesville right now. Nick, Bird is a micromobility company. It is not the only micromobility company. Is the city reaching out to other companies or is anybody knocking on your door?
Yeah, so we're certainly hopeful and we stand ready should another firm approach us. The part of this whole pilot program really helped prep us from a city perspective on what we need to have in place, what an MOU would look like. It's interesting enough, Bird actually approached the city in 2022. So this isn't something the city solicited through a request for proposal, but Bird had just wanted to be a good faith partner. And so they approached us. And that's currently where we're at. We're not going to be soliciting this season for a micromobility firm, but should one approach us, we feel confident and ready to be able to deploy.
You mentioned earlier, you make the case that, hey, Janesville is big enough to sustain micromobility programs like dockless electric scooters. Do you feel like that kind of company will listen to you, or are they going to go for bigger places like Milwaukee?
Yeah, so I think, as some of those firms that had some financial issues that had forced some restructuring, maybe some more focus on higher profit, higher population count markets, maybe get a little firmer footing under them, I would certainly think that they could start to see a market like Janesville reemerge as something. Like I said, we had tremendous local partners for them to contract with. So I think with that added benefit, we will remain maybe an attractive expansion market.
I guess the big question, Nick, is now that Bird is gone, are you hearing from Janesville residents like, hey, I'm bummed. I miss these things.
Yes. Yeah. I think there was certainly some sadness from our residents. when Bird announced that they wouldn't be returning to Janesville for the 24 season. And interestingly enough, you know, still every day as I make my little commute here to City Hall, I'm seeing more and more sort of self-owned scooters crop up, or maybe people that got a taste of Bird, got a taste of micromobility, and maybe they're going out and purchasing an e-scooter or an e-bike themselves. And so I think that's an added benefit of having done this pilot program, is that now our planning, our transportation folks are just more equipped to hopefully handle what is a positive change when it comes to expanding micromobility.
Nick, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Yes, thanks for having me, Rob.
Nick Files is the assistant to the city manager for the city of Janesville. He was with us to share what happened with Bird scooters leaving Janesville earlier this year.
Other Wisconsin cities like Eau Claire and Oshkosh have passed ordinances to allow for dockless electric scooters, but city officials told us so far no companies have moved forward with a program in those communities.
Read more about electric scooter programs across the state over at WPR.org.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today, and when you're looking for the top news from around the state, you can check out WPR's podcast. It's called Wisconsin Today Morning News. That's Wisconsin Today Morning News in one quick listen.
It's available now. Subscribe and listen wherever you get your podcasts, or check it out at WPR.org. While you're there, find out how you can stream live Wisconsin Public Radio's networks and where you can listen around the state.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, as UW lacrosse students packed up and moved out at the close of the semester, they could toss their unwanted furniture into dumpsters destined for the local Habitat for Humanity chapter. We learn about this new diversion program and how it can be replicated on other college campuses.
That's up next here on Wisconsin Today from WPR.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. If you spend time on or near college campuses, you know the college semester is over once couches and microwaves hit the curbs, when it's time for students to move out.
Wisconsin University is trying to cut back on that flow of garbage.
UW La Crosse and Habitat for Humanity of the Greater La Crosse Region have a new partnership to help prevent items from needlessly entering the landfill during those move-out days.
Caitlin Weehy works on sustainability projects with Habitat for Humanity in La Crosse. Caitlin, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks, Kate. It's great to be here.
Well, why does La Crosse need a dumpster diversion program?
Well, you know, there are three college campuses in La Crosse. And college campuses are actually, during move-out season, it's one of the largest generators of waste throughout the year. So, and just the way that college campuses are set up, everything is meant to be disposable. Oh, I could buy another one next year. So the dumpsters fill up pretty quickly. And most of the time, basically all the time, it's usable items that can be going to a new home. So we really want to divert those items and put them to use elsewhere. Just because someone else is done using them doesn't mean that their lifespan is over.
So campuses being one of the largest sources of waste in communities, what are some of the common items that students tend to toss out at the end of the semester?
Yeah, it really varies from campus to campus. Here at UWL, we've seen a lot of futons and larger items, especially with large item pickup going away in the city of La Crosse. Off-campus students are using this as an opportunity to get rid of their old couches and other large items such as that. We also see a lot of microwaves, mini fridges, and of course, ramen noodles.
Ramen noodles?
Yep. All sorts of ramen.
So you also take non-perishables. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, we take everything that can be used again. Clothes, food, personal care items, feminine care products, large items like couches and futons, storage containers, literally everything that still has life left in it.
Where did the idea to start a dumpster diversion program at UW La Crosse, how did it evolve? Where did it come from?
Yeah, so Habitat for Humanity of the Greater La Crosse region has wanted to do a dumpster diversion program with one of the college campuses here in La Crosse for quite a few years now. And the way that it all got started this time around was we had been thinking about it, and one of the professors here, Emily Whitney, in the public health department, she came into the ReStore one day. She was just shopping and she forgot the leaf to her table. And she got to talking with our ReStore director, Nancy, about doing a dumpster diversion program. And Nancy passed her card upstairs to Amy Smith, our sustainability director. And around that time, they were interviewing for the VISTA position and had brought up the fact that they had wanted to do a dumpster diversion program in my interview. And it just so happens that I had prior experience having created and ran the program at Marist College in Poughkeepsie, New York for 2 years. And so it all just really magically came together. It was quite an awesome start to everything.
When you say VISTA program, is that a program through AmeriCorps that is partnering with Habitat?
Yes, yes. The AmeriCorps VISTA program partners with a number of nonprofits across the country to put people in positions where they can gain experience in the workforce. And yeah, it's a great resume builder and obviously a great experience. I love it here. It's been a wonderful time.
And it is, you know, far from where you attended college, Marist College in New York, that had a similar type of dumpster diversion program. How are you using that experience to establish UW La Crosse's program?
Yeah, so it's definitely informed a lot of the decisions we've made here at UWL. A lot of the, because of course there were difficulties doing it at Marist, one of them being the time crunch in terms of getting students out, but also the volunteers, because during this time, everyone is just trying to leave. And so having enough hands around to help and keep the program running has been a big thing. But luckily this year, it has been an amazing turnout, not only with UWL advertising this to their students and getting a lot of student interest, but Habitat putting it out on their channels. We've filled about a quarter, maybe three-eighths of all of the shifts, which is awesome. It's just enough people for the pilot program to run this year, and we've had a really great turnout overall. That's really the biggest lift with the thing, is having enough people to help.
Caitlin, when you go into these storage containers, how full are they?
They're pretty full, and they fill up quickly. If obviously during the first couple of days of diversion, people aren't really thinking about moving out. They're preparing for finals, but the pods are in place. So that way people can kind of get it in their head that like, oh, I don't need to put this in the dumpster. There's another option here for me. But as move out continued, they fill up, and we had to switch them out quite a few times.
And when we say pods, can you describe what they look like?
Yeah, it's like a 20-foot storage container, basically, that you would see on the back of a truck, just a little bit shorter, but about the same size.
We're talking about a new program at UW La Crosse to reduce the amount of waste that students throw away during campus move-out. Caitlin Weehy is with us, works on sustainability projects with Habitat for Humanity in La Crosse. Caitlin, so 5 storage pods were placed on UW La Crosse's campus to coincide with the end of the semester. You've mentioned that you've had to switch some out. Is this adequate to meet the needs of what is being tossed out?
Oh, most definitely. When we think about college move out and the amount of times that the dumpsters need to get tipped because they fill up so quickly, we actually didn't need to tip a dumpster the entire time that we ran this program.
Wow, that's progress, I would imagine. And so even though these storage units are placed near campus dumpsters, some students may choose to throw away items that still have life to them. How might this issue be addressed in the future?
Well, it all comes down to the messaging and how early we're able to get the messaging out, how many connections we're able to make with students on campus and have these important conversations that, you know, just because you're done using an item doesn't mean that it can't be used again. It's really just about building that mindset of a circular economy and being consistent with that message, because it's not something that's going to go away.
Can you walk us through what happens to items that are put into these storage pods?
Oh, yeah, of course. So once the item is put into the storage pod, the pod becomes a dead zone and nobody can take things out, especially just during this first year. Once the pod is full, it gets taken back to the restore. At the restore, all of the items are cataloged. The pods are weighed using the landfill weigh station. So we get two types of data sets for weight. We get an actual weight of the pod, and then we get the weight based off of the Habitat for Humanity International formula, which is for every $1.50, it's a pound diverted from the landfill. So at the end, when we come up with the numbers, we'll be able to compare the two and see how accurate they were. And not only that, we'll be able to come up with a monetary value for all of the items in the pods. And then finally, once all of those are categorized, we will take some of those items into the restore to be resold. And that profit will go towards building new homes and implementing more sustainable practices in the new homes that we build. And then other organizations, other nonprofits that we've partnered with will have the opportunity to come to the restore and pick through all of the pods and take what they need, essentially.
How many pounds of reused items of waste do you hope to divert in this first year?
Quite a few, hopefully over 5,000.
Wow. Wow. Can you build on that? Do you see an expansion from those pounds in future years?
Oh, most definitely. There has definitely been a learning curve with students at UWL as we all adjust to this new program. As students learn and the years go on about the pods and how to really use them and how to take advantage of that, I believe that we'll definitely see an increase in the amount of poundage that we're able to divert. The other thing is that with that learning curve, people are still putting things that could have been useful into the dumpsters, but as soon as they get thrown in, they either get a little bit waterlogged from all the rain that we've been having or broken just from tossing them in. So as the years go on, we hope to really hammer home the idea that, you know, pod first, and if it really isn't usable, like, let us be the decision makers there and we can put it in the dumpster.
So do volunteers still spend time kind of fishing through dumpsters to look for items that can be repaired?
Oh, most definitely. That is one of the daily jobs, if not the primary job. It's less about making sure and like monitoring the pods, but more so about monitoring the dumpsters and making sure we're stopping students if we see them with a usable item headed straight to the dumpster and being like, hey, look, the pods are over here. We can put that in there and we'll take it. Even if the item has wobbly legs or one of the legs is broken and it just needs an extra screw in it, we can fix it. Those things, we have the ability at the restore with our Habitat team to be able to repair those items. I mean, we have a whole entire repair program dedicated to that.
Are there any items that land in pods that just can't be reused that we might not think about?
It really depends. We've had a complication this year because one of the dumpsters was filled with a very questionable substance on the bottom. So anything that went into there, we haven't really been able to rescue. There isn't really anything that we can't use again. When you look at the items that are in these dumpsters, they're in primarily good condition, just with a few things that maybe make them a little structurally unsound. But we assume that from them being thrown into the dumpster, that's how they got that way. It's just the messaging, keeping the messaging consistent and teaching the students that this is how we participate in a circular economy.
And in that circular economy, after you've reviewed and cataloged such a diverse range of items, how does Habitat then distribute donations to the region, to the La Crosse region?
Yeah, so we've spent the past couple of months reaching out to different nonprofits in the area and kind of gauging what they could use, what they need, what their wish list items are. We've made those connections and offered up the opportunity for them to come and take things out of the pods and just restock whatever they need. whatever's left over, we will try to find a home for if we can't put it in our restore. But we assume that there won't be anything left over at the end of this.
Who could benefit from these futons and these rugs and these other household items?
Oh, yeah. This program at Habitat actually creates a really unique opportunity. We primarily serve low-income families. We build them homes. But we don't really touch on the underserved populations like the homeless population. And the organizations that we're partnering with work directly with that population. So we're able to give back to the exchange, the La Crosse Exchange, and What I Need Now, Coolie Cap Thrift, all of these, Family Promise, all of these great organizations who are working directly with these populations and really reinvigorate them with these items and put them back into the community and give them a new life with people who really need them.
And Caitlin, not having to tip a dumpster, that has climate implications. Can you talk a little bit about how this diversion program might align with the community's climate goals?
Oh my gosh, yes. This is keeping so much waste out of our landfill. Like, I think the community will really be shocked to hear the final numbers on everything when we realize this is just a third of what we've been throwing away every single year. Keeping things out of our landfill is so important. I mean, once the landfill fills up, we have to go find another piece of land to use and fill it up again. And, you know, that land is then contaminated from all of the different items that are going in there. A lot of them are pollutants. We talk about microplastic in the soils, the stormwater runoff there, all going into our rivers, lakes, and streams. It provides a huge environmental benefit to be keeping these items out of the landfill.
How could other communities in Wisconsin model this? How could they adopt a similar dumpster diversion program?
Yeah, so I won't say it's easy, but the method behind the madness can definitely be replicated. You need a lot of community connections, a lot of volunteers, and a little bit of time to get everything organized. You basically designate certain zones as donation stations and have people bring their items there over a period of time. And then organizations can either come to that site or they can be transported somewhere and just give them back into the community. And how you give them back into the community, you can do it through nonprofits. You can do it through just an open event, a big old neighborhood swap. There are tons of different ways to be able to run a program like this. And it really just depends on your community's needs and your creativity.
How much volunteer muscle do you need to have within a community to pull it off?
I would say you need at least two people per shift per station. So in this case, we have four shifts across the day. It's about eight people times five, about 40 people a day to be able to lift things together. But yeah, it's not a lot of work, really. You just kind of sit there, talk to people, talk about the program, where your items are going, the impact that they have. And this program also alleviates a lot of guilt for people, especially during move out. I mean, we can all think back to when we were moving out and we just didn't have any space in our cars. And the only option was to put it in the dumpster because there was nothing else to do with it. And nobody wants to do that.
Well, Caitlin, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you. It was so great to be here.
Caitlin Weehy is with the Habitat for Humanity of the Greater La Crosse Region. Hey, Rob, so were you in the passenger seat when your teens were getting behind the wheel and learning to drive?
I was. I was ready for the worst and nervous coming into it, but you know, it actually went pretty well.
So we're exploring stories of teen driving, and we want to find out from you, how do teens in your life feel about driving? What issues came up around driver's ed or getting a permit, taking the test to get a license? Do they even have the desire to drive? So wherever you are in the state, let us know about it.
Leave us a message or text right now at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. You can also find that number at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today, where you can text us as well.
We want to hear your stories about teen driving, and we'd love to share them on a future program.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.